As everyone knows, in the Bible, human beings are thrown out of paradise because Adam has a piece of fruit. In fact, as the French gourmet writer Brillat Savarin said, "Oh, you first parents of humanity who had us tossed out of paradise for an apple, what would you have done for a truffled turkey?" It wasn't, in fact, an apple. That's based on a Latin mistranslation. But whatever fruit it was, a fig is a good candidate, since later, of course, they clothed themselves with fig leaves. Whatever fruit it was, it presages, in a way, what happens to Noah. Because after the flood, as you have heard from our bar mitzvah this morning, Noah sins with the fruit of the vine. He becomes drunk. He plants a vineyard. And these two events require asking, what does the Bible have against fruit? I mean, you think about it for a minute. We get kicked out of paradise because of fruit. Noah loses his heroic status because of fruit. There's got to be something here with fruit that deserves some examination. And in fact, I think there is something symbolic about fruit, which was as close to an extravagant dessert as you could get before the days of, say, Krispy Kreme and Pinkberry. There was only fruit. When kids would say to their parents, "Can I have dessert?" they had a choice of figs or pears or apples or melons, but nothing artificial. And yet, the fruit, standing as a symbol in some ways of excess, stands for different kinds of excess in the case of Adam, in the case of Noah. And what I want to do is not so much explore the fruits of sin, which was the somewhat misleading title of the sermon today. You know, there are two noises that you can be relied on to hear in every sermon, probably all across the country. One is the sound of a cell phone, and the other is that invariably follows it. So let me characterize those two noises. The noise of sin and the noise of self-righteousness. Those are the two noises that we hear in every sermon all across America. Both of them, of course, precious to the preacher, because without them, what would we do? Anyway, back to sin. Let's try to distinguish between Adam's sin and Noah's sin. There were two trees from which Adam and Eve could have eaten. Eitz Chaim, the Eitz Da'at Tov V'ra, the tree of life and the tree of knowledge of good and evil. As Elie Wiesel points out, how remarkable that human beings faced with that choice choose the tree of knowledge. That in some ways our thirst to know is even greater than our thirst to live. And that's in part why people sacrifice themselves as they do for knowledge and for growth. Adam's sin was one of disobedience, but also of aspiration. Adam wanted to be greater. Eden was a gilded cage, and you could be happy there, but it was a steady state happiness, not a happiness of growth. Noah's sin, on the other hand, was a sin of obliteration. After what he had gone through, he couldn't take anymore. As T.S. Eliot writes, humankind cannot bear too much reality. And Noah had had too much reality, and he wanted to escape. We can understand Noah's dilemma. What he had just endured was unimaginable. That's why, as I pointed out to a class the other day, whenever you see a child do a picture of the Noah story, they always do a picture of animals going onto the ark. They never show you everybody drowning in a flood. But that is, in fact, the stark image of what Noah presents. It's not only an image of the wonderful collection of species, it's an image of horror. And Noah, having gone through that, couldn't stand it anymore. And so he gets drunk. But the choice for awareness, the choice for complexity, the choice to endure, difficult as it may be, that's the moral choice. The philosopher John Stuart Mill once wrote in his journal that it is better to be Socrates unsatisfied than a pig satisfied. He said, now a pig may not agree with this, but Socrates would, and a pig only knows one side of the question. Socrates knows both. In other words, a human being, a Noah, if you will, understood what it was to be aware and unaware and made the choice to wipe out the world. But pain is a signal that something is wrong. And you don't get rid of what is wrong by getting rid of the pain. Quite the opposite, actually, is the case. I remember many years ago, the first time that I was invited to speak at a meeting of Jewish Alcoholics Anonymous. And I gave a little opening drasha, a little opening talk, and then, of course, people went around and they all spoke, and one man got up and he said, I started drinking when I was 17, and I stopped drinking when I was 35. And when I woke up at 35, I had the emotional maturity of a 17-year-old. Because since I had no pain, I never grew. That's the dilemma that Noah faces. Does he come to grips with what he has just endured, or does he seek to forget it? And of course, as you know, his forgetfulness leads in time to the sin of his children, which reminds you that every action you take as a human being is not an isolated moral action. It is also an action that ripples out into the community. And what Noah chooses to do has implications beyond Noah. So what was the difference? Why did Adam eat and grow, and Noah ate and obliterated his awareness of the world? You have to assume that what Noah went through was a crisis of meaning. He could no longer find meaning in the world, and so he wanted to escape. And it's a particular irony, because what did Noah do through the ark? His job was to feed the animals and to stay on the boat. And the moment he steps off the ark, he could plant conceivably any plant in the world. In other words, he could have chosen to feed the world. But he plants a vineyard. And, say the rabbis, in a beautiful connection, where did Noah all of a sudden get a seed to plant the vineyard? They say he rescued it from Eden in the hope of reversing Adam's sin. But you have to assume that before he got on the ark, he collected lots of different plants. But in the end, he cannot find the meaning to do that which he was assigned to do, which is to take care and to feed and to grow a new world. Obviously, Noah is in its way a unique story. But as the Latin poets tell us, change the name and the story is about you. Because the difference between Noah and someone who comes through a trial or a tragedy, somebody who survives and goes on to lead a moral and giving and aware life, the difference between the two is stamina. I know you've marveled, as I have, at people who step out of the concentration camps and don't give up on the world, but create and build and grow, and you think to yourself, how can they do it? And the answer is that they succeed where Noah failed. that they still believe in the possibility of doing something in this world, despite or maybe even because of what they have seen. Because they know how evil the world can be, they also glimpse the possibility of goodness. How often do you hear people say, I know that I acted badly, but you have to understand what I went through? As though feeling pain gives you the right to inflict pain. But Noah was wrong about that. And that's why the founders of the Jewish people are not Noah and Noah's children, but Abraham, who went through trauma and yet, at the end of his life, grew from it. And Abraham's last public action is an action of care, burying his wife. Noah, by the way, for the next 350 years that he lives, according to the Bible, does not have a single action worth recording. After the sin of his children, he curses and blesses them, and then lives for 350 years, and there is nothing. Moses, at the end of his life, having endured the trauma not only of the liberation from Egypt, but the wandering through the desert, gathers the people together before his death and blesses them and foretells the future. In other words, generativity, creativity, until the very last day, because he still believes in meaning. Because he's not ready to give up. Because he will not allow the trauma that he endured to be an excuse to inflict trauma on those who come after. That's part of the meaning of the Noah story. Because Noah is going to be the new Adam, after all, when we say that we're all descended from Adam, we could just as easily say we're all descended from Noah. Because Noah is going to be the new Adam, he has a special responsibility to teach the lesson to his children and his children's children, that whatever terrible may happen to you in life, and God knows terrible things will happen, that it does not mean that you cannot out of that create beauty, that you cannot still shape meaning, that you cannot still find goodness, that you cannot start again. We just finished reading the Torah, and now we have started again. And if you ask, why do we start again? After all, we just read it. The answer is that in every story, in every lifetime, in every renewal, there is, if you pay attention, the effect of a spiral. You don't just go around, you ascend. You go up. And you go deeper. Noah cut off his experience at the very moment when he had something new to teach the world. And we see that in all the great religious figures that followed. So what lesson do we take from Noah, especially on this Rosh Chodesh, when the sky is dark and the moon is just beginning to grow and shed its light on the night? That in darkness, light is promised. That, as Rabbi Yochanan says in the Midrash, the eye, the human eye, has a light part and a dark part. And you can only see through the dark part. That in difficulty, in trial, whether individual or communal or national or indeed universal, there is wisdom and growth and meaning, and that human beings have a choice. They can turn away from the world, or they can recreate it. Noah turned away. Next week, we read the story of Abraham and Sarah, who together recreated a new world and gave birth to a promised people who, we pray hand in hand with all of humanity, seek again to learn the lesson that out of pain there is growth, out of trauma there is meaning, and in the darkness we can find God. Shabbat Shalom.